Hey everybody, welcome to episode 39 of the podcast, released on Devil's Night. Hope everyone's having a good Halloween, and as we gear up for the festive holidays, I am not slowing down. My guest this week, Andrew Catlin, better known to you and the world as The Lasso, is someone I've been a fan of for a while, and I'm very excited to have him swing through the Bedroom Beethoven studio to chat.
Fires rage on beads of glass, turning present into past. Take what was theirs and make it yours. No longer sheltered from the shore. New York money on the coast. Currency as real as ghosts. Rivals burn along the shore. Take the trees from Singapore. Take the trees from Singapore.
He has a new project with rapper Chris Oreck. Now, cryptozoologist Chris Oreck died last March, and the Detroit vocalist with the same name woke up and read the news of his namesake's death. That can mess with one man's mind, and this sparked a journey into a subculture of folklore, and that seed grew over the months into a dark, industrial, and abstract record called I Read That I Was Dead. So check it out, guys. BedroomBeethovens.com is the website. 5-7 Collective is the gang. And these shows are on all platforms, from Pandora to YouTube to Stitcher to Spotify. Just pick one and you're off to the races. And please visit patreon.com/bedroombeethovens to support the show directly so I can keep eating. All right, guys. This is episode 39 with producer The Lasso on the new record, I Read That I Was Dead. I'm your host, Cello, and you were jacked into the podcasting matrix. And
it's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, there's not a lot of information out there on you, so I hope that we can kind of share with the world a little more about you.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man.
So you're from Grand Rapids?
Yeah, I was born in Grand Rapids. I lived there for a while. I lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan for a while. So yeah, like kind of the west side of Michigan was where I grew up.
Were you in Detroit at all?
Well, my parents are from here and all my family lived out here, so I've always had the connection. My mom grew up in a part of Detroit called Delray, so this was always where we came out to see family and whatnot. So always been a part of my life.
I learned that before you were 10, you were interested in music, and before you graduated high school, you knew how to play 5 instruments.
Yeah, I certainly, the moment playing music came into my life, it was pretty much an instant obsession. And you know, I was privileged and lucky enough to, you know, still be going to public school at the time where you know, music classes were common. So I started learning the clarinet actually when I was in fifth grade, and haven't ever kind of, the passion's never gone away from there. It's like the music's changed a lot, but I've kind of was obsessed the moment I started.
Yeah, I wanted to ask how, because like, you know, I played the trumpet in high school, and that was like, I remember that was like a $600 instrument. So if I wanted to play another instrument, my parents would have just been like, get better at the trumpet. I'm not buying you any more $600 instruments. So like, how did you pull that off? Were you able to learn so many instruments at that time in your life?
You know, I started with clarinet. My parents were renting me a clarinet from like a local music store. And then the second instrument I learned how to play was a tuba. And my school had a program where you could learn a second instrument. They just had like old loaner ones. I swear they'd probably been there since the 70s. Just kind of raggedy old instruments. Then, you know, just my family embraced it. My grandpa had like a old Yamaha, like fake grand piano, plasticky kind of keyboard that he gave me. And then really, to be honest, I got a job when I was in ninth grade of high school as a working at a community pool, and I just saved up money, and that's what I was doing with my, you know, I was either buying CDs from the record store or saving up for gear. And you know, I started to record bands in high school and charge them a little bit of money and stuff. So I certainly having this like 20-hour, 15-hour a week weekend job when you're in ninth grade, you know, it's like, you know, it's not like you have to pay for food and shit if your family's supporting you. So it's like I had that extra income stream.
No doubt, man.
To buy a little 4-track. And then certainly, like, that's all I would, you know, if a birthday or Christmas would result in me getting a gift, I was asking for money towards gear. It was just, that's what I like to do. And so that's what my focus was in terms of, like, I didn't play video games really that much or anything. So
yeah, I think from like a perspective of your parents, though, it's like I got two kids, and my wife is always saying that I'm hard on them because instead of letting them run around and jumping creeks and kicking ant piles, I'm always saying like practice gymnastics or you need to read a book or go on YouTube and watch a nature show, because I'm hoping that something sticks. Like my daughter will see a bear catch a salmon and now she wants to be the next crocodile hunter or something. But maybe I should just stop and let it happen natural. Your grandpa had no idea he was going to give you a Yamaha at some point. So maybe I should just sit back and let them find their own thing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think certainly that was the case. Like there was never any, no one in my family is really a musician. They're all big music fans and my parents had a cool record collection and whatnot. And we're always down to like, they were like the parents who, you know, they drove me and my friends to concerts. So, I mean, as soon as they saw that I was like interested and had this like passion beyond something casual, like, you know, they loved it. They loved hearing me play music. So I was really lucky in terms of that to have that them support this thing that I was getting obsessed with.
And then the decision to move to Arizona, what factors went into that? Was like, was your wife on board? Was it spontaneous?
It was very much based around, yeah, my wife got a job. She was a public school, like elementary school teacher, and she got a job down there. So we were just like, you know, you grow up in the Midwest and you fascinate about, you fantasize about other climates because the winters are so harsh here that when we had the opportunity to move to Arizona, we jumped on it. Just seemed like the right time in our lives to get a fresh start and just see a different part of the country. But yeah, it just kind of really came about totally like chance opportunity.
Well, I want to level with you because I'm located in Central Texas. It doesn't snow here, by the way. It's just hot all the damn time. But uh-huh. My wife and I, we've been out here our entire lives. Like, she signed my 7th grade yearbook. We grew up down the street from one another. So when I tell you that I need a spontaneous 1,000-mile journey myself, it would be an understatement. I'm like, I'm so sick of my town. Would you recommend maybe moving a few states over as a means to rejuvenate oneself?
Yeah, absolutely. It was just a life-changing experience for me. And I'm always telling people, you know, I lived there for 4 years and it was like every day was exciting just because there was just the way everything looked and the feel of the air, like everything had this newness to it, which is just such a great life experience to be able to like live in a way that every day you feel really fresh and excited just to even, you know, take a walk or drive somewhere or anything. So yeah, it really changed my life, you know. Obviously, there were a lot of musical things that came out of it, but just purely in terms of being a happy person.
Well, let's talk about that music side. Now you have a little bit of validation when you moved, because let's just say I take your advice. I move 1,000 miles. I'm sitting in my living room. I'm looking at my hands and I'm like, Lord, send me a sign. Did I make the right move? But you took fate into your own hands. You decided to go to a show. And boom, Scorsese found his DiCaprio. Lando's right there performing on stage. Got that Wu-Tang juice, and it tastes so good.
It ain't too early in the morning for some sex, but it's early in the morning, early in the morning. I'm just on the like peace on my mind.
Yeah, no doubt. Like, I was at this kind of like crossroads in my music career. At that point, I had toured a ton. I had engineered and produced just I'm not exaggerating when I say like hundreds of albums. I was just an engineer for years, and I would work with any genre, any people, and I kind of burnt out on being a commercial engineer. So when I moved to Tucson, you know, I was like, I'm starting fresh with music, and I'm gonna just focus on my, you know, playing, my production, not doing anything that I don't really want to do. So as soon as I got there, I was going to every hip hop show, every beat show I could find. And the first show I went to, Lance was performing. It was like a block or two from my house at this little outdoor venue. And, you know, I wanted to find someone who could rap and could sing and, you know, saw themselves as like a vocalist with a lot of different tools in their kit. And like, you know, yeah, serendipitously, you know, I run into Lando who was able to do all that and a lot more.
There's an MC performing on stage. What are you paying attention to that maybe people in the crowd aren't paying attention to?
Specific with Lance, it was like, if I give this person, because my beats just have a different feel than a lot of people, and it kind of is like, are you gonna just put bars over this, or are you gonna, you know, write it, see this as like the setting and write a character into this play, this thing? And Lance can do that both lyrically and sonically, you know, fluidly switching between singing and rapping, and also, you know, being able to write hooks, but writing verses, the spoken word elements of what he does. Like, he just, like, if Lance writes a hook, you know, we can spend a half hour going through different ways he can perform that hook before we decide on one. So there was just so much ability for him to be able to find himself in any given beat or across a wide variety of style. And I heard that in him just in the music he was making at that time. Like, he was working with other producers.
One of the handful of producers who worked on The Boy Who Spoke to the Wind was accused of sexually assaulting one of Lando's close friends shortly after that album was released last year. Now, a PR release is going to say Lando on his next album wants to work with The Lasso to achieve a more singular sound. But if you ask me, I think after an incident like that, he wanted to reduce his circle and only bring in people he trusts. And maybe there was a bit of regret that you guys didn't exclusively work together the way you planned it when you were at the Scratch Shack all those years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to comment on the heavy part of that, but I also am just like, I don't think of any producer-musician relationship as like exclusive. Like, it's magic when you, like, a producer and a vocalist can really have this symbiotic, you know, proprietary vision of sound together. And, like, you could want that for years and hope it could happen with a vocalist out there, but it only happens when it does and it's real, you know? So, like, regardless of any other social factors that might have gone into that decision, it was just like, we very sincerely developed that relationship over time, you know? Like, we couldn't have done it earlier than we did, because it takes just time spent to really build that kind of trust in a creative collaboration, and also try enough things to find your unique sound. Like, there's so much music Lance and I tried before we started to really find our sound.
The only reason why I asked that question is I thought that you got signed to Mello because of the duo of you and Lance at the time.
It's funny, man. It's like, I was that first Lando album, like, I have nothing that was done by the time I moved to Tucson. Like, he had kind of sat on that album for a while. And it's funny, so he had this album done, and then we met and started to collaborate, and then we had, like, a live band at that time, and we just were having a lot of success in Tucson as, like, a local band that was bringing out a ton of people. And it just so happens, like, Mike, who owns Mello Music Group, lives in Tucson, so, you know, he has his ear to the ground, and Lance... We did this release show for Mark Your Son prior to Mello being involved. Like, Lance self released it, and he got on the cover of the local music magazine, and we had this huge release show. And so that's really what brought Mello to us, was like, oh, you know, here's this like hip hop group in the town I live in who has some like a real you know, following like kind of thing brewing here. So yeah, it was just a confluence of a lot of things, but certainly our collaboration gave them a lot of confidence in signing us, in the sense that, you know, we had a vision for a couple of years of all this music we wanted to make. And, you know, while I wasn't involved in For Mark Your Son, the shows we were playing at that time, like, we had this sound locked in by that point.
Because Mellow Music Group almost overnight became a producer collective. You have Eloquent, Odyssey, Mr. Liff, Nolan the Ninja. So when a consumer like myself looks at it, it's almost by design. Is being a solo artist and releasing beat tapes, was that always part of the vision? Was that always the plan?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who knows me well is gonna, with pretty quickly, realize that I have a you know, pretty intense relationship with music, and can just have a pretty incredible output. Like, I work at it like an athlete does, and treat it like exercise. You know, I never asked to, I'm not going to bother someone about signing me or something. It's like, I'm going to show you what I can do. I create a ton of music. I have a ton of drive with it. And whether someone signed me or not, I'd be living this life anyways. You know, I've been recording music for so long, and I'll do it till the day that I die. So it's that sincere passion and obsession with it that afforded me to get signed, you know. And it's like, I always got ideas for instrumental albums, collaborations. Like, there's not enough hours in my life to see through all the stuff I want to do with music.
Yeah, I think the biggest compliment I can afford you is you don't take the archetype of what an instrumental album should be. You kind of buck away from that. But I feel like, or maybe you feel like that. Do you feel the success of your body of work with Lando and Fingers Crossed, this Chris Oreck album, are more suited for Mellow Music Group rather than your solo instrumental albums? Like, do you feel your solo work could be more successful if it wasn't housed within a hip hop label? Perhaps the intended audience isn't hearing it, and the core hip hop fans don't know how to listen to it.
Yeah, there's an element of that there, but I also like that. And, you know, I'm not speaking for the label, but I think it's a cool growth opportunity or something fresh for them to do. Is like, yeah, certainly, like, all my music's grounded in hip hop and beat making, but, you know, I take it other places, and they're not scared of that as a label. Like, they're a label that's very much founded upon, like, letting artists see through their, you know, very sincere, like, visions of what they want to do with music. So, I mean, yeah, there's still a lot of work for me to connect my solo music with people out there who would like it. You know, I don't feel like I'm in a rush with any of this, you know. Like, I think there's a lot of people out there, you know, you're on social media all day, you're reading about the music industry, and you're in a race to get something. I that's just not who I am, you know. I'm just making as much music as I can and being the best artist that I can and growing. And I believe, like, great music finds its audience with time. It's not about release weeks or anything else. I mean, so much of the music I'm obsessed with came out 20 years ago, and, you know, it's finding a fan in me now. So
yeah, that's really refreshing to hear. Usually hip-hop, it's like, I'm gonna build my career on building a first classic album, and then we're gonna slowly go downhill for the next 20 years. So I'm glad that you're thinking, like, this isn't a race. I'm glad to hear that, because I have to admit, I was surprised that you didn't release your solo albums on another label and then release your producer work with artists on Mellow. And I think that just speaks to your loyalty as an artist as well.
Yeah, even if they're a few steps off of, or what their public perception might be, like, oh, it's this boom bap label and very hip hop based, but, like, they're music fans to the fullest, and, you know, record collectors and whatnot. So they hear what I'm going for, and they understand it. And certainly there's nothing like weird behind the scenes about it. Like when I turned in that album, my solo album, they loved it and they were psyched about it.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to understand kind of the psychology behind that. Like Solando doesn't just pick beats that you make, or maybe Chris isn't just picking beats, because I read things like, yeah, so I'm in the basement with Lasso. He made a beat where we dive into the paradigm of entertainment and racial caricatures. And on the next track, Lasso and I set out to create a soundscape, a canvas for our Southwest border influence and Midwest origins. And I'm reading that stuff and I'm like, is it really that poetic? Or, you know.
It's so funny. I'm like, is that pulled from a press release? Yeah, I don't mean Lance and I aren't sitting there saying sentences like yeah. that, but you know, we listened to music a lot together. We talked about feelings, tempos, places we wanted to cover, intersections of genres, and it's never like let's cross this and this. It's kind of like, you know, you hang out with each other every day and you're in the studio all the time, like, and you're trying to keep growing as artists, like, yeah, you're gonna talk about what you're doing, and it's never like super eloquent in the moment like that. It's a soundscape for our it's like those words aren't said at sessions, but you know, there's a conversations that like we want to make a song that doesn't have an ABAB structure. There's a beginning and an end, and you hit a lot of things along the way that only happen once. Like that's more the stuff we talk about, or like the music is going to be still, but you're going to move around it. And through doing that, you know, it's going to feel like a character walking through a soundscape. Like we might say stuff like that, but it's, you know, I'm also someone who just doesn't sit around and like, you can talk a little bit about music, but language is kind of inadequate to really talk about music. So it's like, if I have an idea, I make it and show the artist I'm producing. And that's the most effective way to do that. Like I could sit and say a bunch of nonsense to Lance, or I can make the track that I hear in my head and give it to him. And if I did a good job at it, and there's really legs on that concept, like he's gonna hear it and he's gonna follow through with it.
Originality is something that musicians pride themselves on. I get that, but unfortunately the mainstream consumer base might have a hard time telling the difference. So that's why I asked. It's like if all that wax poetic stuff might get lost in the sauce. So I'm glad you cleared that up. But I think at some point you moved back to Michigan. Chris Oryk's from Michigan. I think I'm sensing a coincidence here.
A week before I moved to Tucson, one of my old hip-hop groups did a show with Chris at the time when he was Red Pill, and his first album, then Mellow, had just dropped. We played together in Detroit, and that was the first time we met, and we were talking backstage, and like, oh yeah, I'm moving to Tucson. And he's like, ah, oh, the label I'm on, the guy who owns it lives out there. And that was like the first time I'd ever have, you know, I had no idea Mellow lived in Tucson at the time I was moving there. So that was kind of this weird thing of like, oh, I had that in my head. And it's like, I never tried to seek him out when I moved there. It just so happened like a year later, you know, he found me and Lance. But so I had that connection with Chris from years ago, kind of just playing this show together. So yeah, when I moved back to Michigan, I mean, I didn't even... The Chris thing came about after I'd already finished the sound of Lasso and turned that into the label. And, you know, I think we both, you know, we kept in touch a little bit via social media and whatnot. And Mello kind of pitched the idea of like, hey, maybe you and Chris want to do something together. And we're both like, yeah, we've thought about that before. And, you know, it ends up we live a couple, just like a mile or two from each other. So it was kind of like.
You both by happenstance just live a couple miles apart.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. At the beginning of this podcast, I'm going to play a song called Singapore, Michigan, which is a true ghost town.
Oh, is it? Yeah, I know the like kind of history of that place.
I think now it's like a tourist attraction because it's like a true ghost town, I think.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, you know, and getting into the, like, the whole concept of Chris's album, you know, I guess that, you know, there's a lot of like looking out at the world in this album of Chris's, and mixed with some introspection and a lot of, you know, political, social commentary. And I think one of the concepts in the album is kind of like greed. And, you know, you look at Singapore, Michigan was kind of this weird, you know, a bunch of wealthy people from New York moved there in the 1800s to start like this kind of boom town, but they, you know, took down so many of the tree line that like the city ended up kind of getting ravaged by just like not having the wind blockage of this trees anymore, and it became this weird ghost town. And I think they're cutting down a lot of the trees to use to repair stuff from the Chicago fire. So, you know, I think Chris kind of used that as this metaphor for greed and like, you know, the casualties that can come with that.
Is that why it's a ghost town? Those like the great fires of Michigan, and they never rebuilt from that, because that was like 100 years ago or something.
Yeah, they never rebuilt from that. Yeah, I think it's like, yeah, it's not really like a town anymore. It's just kind of, it was there.
I guess he's taking his mortality in the question, and if he comes to you with a concept like that, that's a tall order. How do you even begin to create sounds for such an idea? You touched on, what was it, greed? That was the first concept for one track?
Yeah. I mean, why don't I just do a little rundown on the concept of this album? Because it was cool, man. It was like, Chris and I had been working together for months, and, you know, I had given him, by that point, an entire album worth of beats and beyond, and it was going pretty well, and we had some cool cuts done, and then, you know, someone tagged him in a post on Twitter being like, you know, rest in peace to cryptozoologist Chris Oreck, but, you know, had meant to tag, I suppose, the other Chris Oreck, who was this cryptozoologist, and that kind of, like, started this whole, you know, and Chris went and read his obituary, being like, what is this? And found that, you know, not only was this guy kind of this weird, fascinating dude who had devoted his life to cryptozoology, which is a weird thing to begin with.
Yeah, tell me about it.
You know, he was kind of a dude battling his demons and whatnot. Chris kind of was like, he was kind of like, man, some of the things in this guy's obituary might be something someone would say about me.
Now I had read that I had died, RIP to me, but in truth they fed you lies. Everything you see is an optical illusion, and I'm about to prove it to stop all the confusion. Hold up, wait a minute.
I were to die, and it kind of like opened this portal into an album concept of just you know, there's that introspective part about reflecting on yourself and your own mortality, but also we kind of looked into cryptozoology and the concept of, you know, studying, you know, monsters, and oftentimes like these monsters are, you know, reflections of cultural or societal issues and whatnot, and that kind of just gave us this seed that we needed to start an album, in terms of like, all right, it can be this darker, more industrial kind of sound mixed with some ethereal stuff. And if you look at a lot of cryptozoology drawings, they're these very like homemade, hand-drawn things, so we're like, all right, we wanted the album to kind of have that homemade graininess to it.
They never show you the prestige, lead you on and on. No magic in the weeds, and it's easy. They don't even need you to believe, because the truth is, you know, and you choose to be deceived. Hold up, wait a minute.
Yeah, this kind of like chance running into this, you know, obituary of someone with the same name kind of gave us this concept to build an album
off. Well, I'm just glad he doesn't have to change his name again. I know there was, like, with Red Pill, there was, yeah, some association with that.
Yeah, right.
Now this album, you played all the instruments, you recorded it in your attic studio, true bedroom Beethoven. I love it. But this was recorded like on a Russian mic, Polymoon filters. I think you use what, like Farfisa equipment too, that's like vintage 60s Italian stuff. Maybe you can kind of break down for the people why these particular choices and equipments are used.
Yeah. When I moved back to Michigan, like I kind of said, I'd owned this studio here in my early 20s, and I kind of had a lot of gear back here in Michigan that had been in storage. And I spent all these years in Tucson really working up my like beat making game, and I kind of knew when I had to move back to Michigan that I had planned, like, you know what, I'm going to kind of reinvent my sound, and I have all these instruments there, and I play all these instruments, kind of dropping out the sequencers and samples, and kind of, I'd seen that workflow through for so many years. I was like, what's next for me? And it was really owning every sound, playing all the instruments, and, you know, fusing that with my hip hop production. But, you know, there's just this part of me as an engineer and a multi-instrumentalist that it was inevitable at some point I was going to get back to just pure, you know, performance as my main mode of creation. So specific then to Chris's album, you know, it was like just the albums that inspire, you know, the music that was inspiring me at the time that, you know, he pitched me this concept and instantly my head kind of heard these darker cinematic synth, raw kind of weird drum breaks and stuff. You know, it's like I have the instruments I have and I can make a lot of genres with those instruments. But Chris's album was just really natural in terms of like, once he gave me that concept, like I said, there's like a lot of like kind of horror movie synths in there. And, you know, I love like specific to the Farfisa. I don't have my Farfisa anymore. I've sold it, but I use some like kind of clone stuff to get it. Yeah, I'm a big fan of like Goblin, who did all those like 70s Italian slasher movies. So the influences that I had to make this album, you know, kind of lended itself to like fucked up sounding synthesizers, raw kind of drum breaks, like these sort of one chord jams and stuff. Like, I'm really into a lot of like krautrock music, and so it was just like the influences that hit me for this album, you know, that's what kind of dictated the instrumentation, was like the feel of the concept and the music that influenced me to make this album.
Well, earlier in this interview, you said you studied sound engineering, but it sounds also that you kind of hinted that you either didn't enjoy it or you wanted to get away from commercial engineering. Is that kind of why you didn't do it yourself? Because I think you used the same engineer as LaRange, the Drew Vandenberg.
He mixed the album, but I still like engineer and record it all, and then I bring it to him to mix. So I guess when I was speaking to that earlier, it's like I did it professionally for so many years. It's like I can engineer an album of almost any genre and feel really comfortable at a jazz session or anything else as an engineer. But I got real tired of just doing that as like this craft that you're paid for. It's like, regard, you know, you could be recording, as much as I like engineering, like I couldn't hear another, like, I don't care what I'm getting paid for an hour of work. Like, I don't want to hear just like bluegrass music. And like, I didn't want to engineer for anymore if it wasn't my own music or something I really believed in. So coming back to Michigan, it's like, all right, well, I got all this great analog gear out here from when I own this studio. Like, I'm happy to be my own engineer, but I don't want to do it as a job, you know, because usually that really what that means is like once a year you do a great album. The rest of the time you're just recording. You say yes to everything in order to pay the bill of owning a studio.
So as you double down on your music career, are you full time in this?
No, I work part time, but it's still like in the, I work for this company, Vintage King, if you're aware of them. It's like one of the biggest like vintage gear, like outfitters or retailers in the world. So my day job is selling gear and like designing recording studios.
Yeah, well, Chris was able to quit his job as a factory worker, so hopefully both of y'all can be full time soon. That would be a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's more or less full time. I mean, I do it all the time. And, you know, I also like having a part-time job. Like, sometimes it's nice to get out of your own head. And I meet so many people in the industry via my day job at Vintage King. So, you know, I embrace it. As far as a day job goes, it couldn't be closer to what I love doing. And they're good. They're good to me, and I learn a lot about gear and production via my
Can't ask
job.
For more than that. Well, November's a release month. I'm excited, and you have a great story to tell. And don't tell Apollo Brown this, but you might just be my favorite producer from Michigan.
Hey, right on, man. I appreciate you saying that. Yeah, it's I'm really excited about the album, and I got a lot of other cool stuff coming out over this next year. And yeah, just keep it moving. And I love producing for people, and I'm really excited about the opportunity to continue to work with more artists and develop their sound and my own at the same time.
Now, you even did the artwork, man. What can't you do?
Yeah, right on. Yeah, I love, like, that's, you know.
All right, brother. Thanks for being here. And, you know, you just said you had a whole bunch of music, a whole bunch of ideas that'll be pouring out of you from, you know, Q4 2019 through 2020. So please come back anytime you want.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I appreciate you having me.